My name is Tumi Makgetla. It's the 26th of August, 2009. I'm here in Abuja with Senator Ahmed McCarthy, the former governor of Kaduna State from 1999 to 2007, when the state experienced several clashes over the introduction of Sharia law, most notably in 2000. The former governor has been widely acclaimed for his reforms to diffuse the situation and promote dialogue while also improving service delivery in the state. Before we begin, may I just confirm that I've been able to ask any questions you've had about this interview and that it's voluntary?
Absolutely, it is.
Great, thank you. And thank you very much for participating in this series of interviews with reform leaders. As we begin, could you perhaps give me a brief overview of your career and how you came to be the governor of Kaduna State?
Well, excuse me. After my university, graduating from the university, and doing my national youth service in 1983, I started work with the bank. As a matter of fact, that's the only place I work all my life in terms of working career. It was only in that particular bank. And I rose from a supervisor to assistant general manager position, holding different portfolios. I was an assistant general manager when I was appointed in 1993 to the position of a state commissioner for finance and economic planning, and I served for 3 years. After that, I went into my private business. 1997. Of course, politics started then, though, you know, with the Abacha regime, there will be politics, there may not be politics, but one started a little bit of active politics, and while doing, fully doing private business, when in 1998, the transition that led to this democratic governance started. I was one of those who were called the conveners to form the People's Democratic Party. I was one of the five conveners in my state. We convened and formed the party in my state, that's Kaduna State. And of course, the rest is history. I actively participated in the formation of the party, in propagating the manifesto of the party to the people. And I went in for the primaries, you know, for the governorship. Mm-hmm. I won, and I went in for the election, and I won, and I served 2 terms. And now I'm in the Senate, mm-hmm. having reached the constitutional limit on how many times I can serve as governor of a state.
Mm-hmm. Great. So when you think back to those early days of the reform, or when you first became governor, how did you set your priority agenda, your agenda for the major issues and challenges that you might want to address in office?
Well, I come from a community that is highly political, you know, right from the time of struggle for Nigeria's independence. You know, you had then in Nigeria parties, you can say, a little bit more radical. I wouldn't say we never had any socialist or communist party, but more on the left. You know, it's just like, you know, the Republicans are where they stand, you know, where the Democrats are on the liberal side here, on the conservative side, though they're all, on the same line, or in the Labour or Conservative Party in UK. That's what we have in Nigeria, really, nothing socialist or communist, but a question of, well, all on the right, but far to the right and maybe a little bit to the left of the right. So my community has been highly political. And right from the time I was growing up, because we were more on the opposition side, mm-hmm. we were a little bit leftist. Kind of. I had seen a lot as a kid growing up. Of course, we are leftists more because we were fond of challenging the establishment. You know, we don't want this monarchy and the way they used to wield and their power and influence. We don't want to be put under some kind of restrictions or control. We wanted to be independent, you know, freedom to do what we wanted, all those sort of things. So I grew up under that. My parents were key agitators and participants in that, and they went to jail because of that. And as a kid, I used to visit them, even in jail, take food to them, just for standing up to their right. And that started kind of molding me in a particular pattern. And I said, okay, well, the ideas for which they were fighting, I fully subscribe to, but maybe when I grow up, I will carry on in a different way. In a different way in the sense that maybe they were doing it from the point of weakness. I will try to do it from a point of strength. I will try to grow up, get educated, be a little bit well off, be a little bit financially and economically independent, while continue, you know, the struggle. And I got the opportunity when I was appointed commissioner for finance and economic planning. And as the portfolio implies, I was in charge of both budgeting and implementing. And not just budgeting, even the planning aspect, medium, long term. So that enabled me to know about a lot about the past about my state and to try to develop some ideas about the future for the state. And of course, when I was where I was also appointed, it was just after, not long after the Zongwan Katap crisis. There was a crisis, ethno-religious, very serious one. The first major serious ethno-religious crisis in Kaduna State. It was during military time. And I participated in series of meetings, you know, between in order to bring peace and stability among the warrior, the communities, and also that enriched my knowledge about the underlying issues in the state, ethno-religious, some of them economic, but you know they get tainted or be clouded as if they were really ethnic or religious, whereas maybe there were economic issues, only that struggle between somebody from one ethnic group and another person from a different ethnic group, or someone from one religious background with another person from a different religious background, but all struggle over economic issue. So it becomes interpreted religious, whereas the conflict really, when you look at it deeply, it was economic. So with all these experiences, I developed this concept that, look, one, I have had traveled widely across the state for 3 years, having served in the cabinet. I've seen the topography of the state. I've seen physically, you know, the needs, you know, I've seen in person, not that I've had, you know, the conditions under which people lived, you know, under which they studied, under the condition of the farming, the healthcare system, you know. I participated in budgeting and implementation. I participated in planning, in supervision, supervising what is being implemented. And I've had interacted with people to deal with issues of conflict resolution. So I came into office really to try to improve what I had seen in, you know, in those years of service that, you know, I serve as commissioner for finance and economic planning. Even though I did not bargain the problem that came to Thal, but I knew there were underlying issues, more of what we call self-determination, because the state being multi-ethnic, over about 50 different ethnic tribes. And I know that for decades, or even some communities for up to a century, they have been seeking for this independence for, you know, from one dominance, from dominance by one establishment or the other. What I mean is that, you know, we have emirates here and chiefdoms. And, you know, the dominant in the state was the Zazo Emirate. And the Zazo Emirate was started right from, not even before the Namfodio time, even before then there was Zazo Emirate. And Zazo Emirate expanded up to Abuja here then, right from there up to Abuja here. But of course, you know, there were limitations when they were colonized, and it limited to southern part of the state. And southern part of the state are majority Christians, mm-hmm. and also very, very multi-ethnic. A lot of them were brought under the Zazo Emirate. So they've been seeking for this self-identity. They wanted to be on their own. They wanted to have their own chief. They wanted to have their own king. They should not be subjugated under one cultural dominance, one traditional dominance. And coupled to this cultural and traditional dominance is also the difference in religion. So this struggle for some decades, some for up to 100 years have been there. And I came into office with an intention to look into this, mm-hmm. to see how, not by force, but through dialogue and consensus, we can make others see wisdom mm-hmm. in giving people their self-determination within the context of giving them their independent traditional identity under their own local chief and the rest. So this was something that people shied away from touching and had intention of looking into them, because we believe that doing so will bring, you know, enhance the peace and stability of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And we've not gotten it wrong,
mm-hmm.
because we did so. And because we did that and other reforms,
mm-hmm.
you can see that there have been other troubles in different parts of the country,
mm-hmm.
but Kaduna never reacted.
Mm-hmm.
Before any part of the country that there was any form of crisis, Kaduna would be the first to react.
Mm-hmm.
Or either it starts from Kaduna, or it would be the first place to react.
Mm-hmm.
But because we had addressed so many of these socio-cultural issues, it went a very, very long way.
Mm-hmm.
To my thinking, that most of the reaction, even before, was more because people felt denied, people felt subjugated, people felt, you know, subjected to a system they didn't like. So they were looking for opportunity to vent their anger. You know, and by addressing those issues,
mm-hmm.
that issue was no longer there. So except if an issue really came and touched them personally,
mm-hmm.
they were not prone to begin to react
mm-hmm.
to external issues.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you can go more into detail into the changes that you were able to bring as governor of the state, these reforms that you were discussing. Which would you consider the most important in terms of their impact on the community, or their indirect impact in terms of widening the arena for reform?
Well, first of all, the reform of the traditional and cultural system by establishing, giving each ethnic group its independent identity and traditional establishment, that's a very, very major one. As I mentioned earlier, some of them for up to 100 years have been struggling for that. And we saw records that they had been struggling for that. Some for maybe not of 100 years, but, you know, for mm-hmm. a couple of decades. Two, because the 2000 crisis was because of the introduction of Sharia in neighboring states. We had not introduced Sharia when we had crisis.
Mm-hmm.
No. You know, that's wrong. But in the year 2000, We do not have Sharia law within the context that, you know, people are talking of. We only have, you know, what has been there right from the time Nigeria came to be. What happened was that neighboring states introduced Sharia. And there was agitation by Muslim group in the state for similar. Meanwhile, there was counter-agitation against by the Christian community. And so we had a situation where today there will be a demonstration for, tomorrow there will be a demonstration against. And that went out of control. They went for each other and the crisis started. We never even made any statement or even set up any procedure to set up, you know, to introduce Sharia. But when that happened, we said, okay, the worst has happened. We have to talk out to ourselves. We set up leaders of thought forum from the Muslim and Christian community, co-chaired by a Muslim and a Christian statesman. And we asked them to look into the issue and discuss and let them on their own tell us how they want us to approach the issue. So we kind of threw the ball, you know, to in their court, saying, tell us how do you want us to approach it. Apart from that, tell us other things you think government should do that your people or our people really want government to do. And that worked very well. One, it wasn't easy. It took a lot of, you know, encouragement from us, you know, indirectly behind the scene, because we're monitoring the discussion, and anytime they were going to derail, we go at night, sit with them, you know, separately or together, and try to put them back on track, but let them go and talk themselves. At the end of the discussion, at the end of the negotiation and dialogue, amongst the people themselves, they came off, and it was also our idea anyway, because we sold the idea to them. Because you see, you can't set up people without you having an objective. When you develop the objective and you set the people, you have to try and push the idea through them so that they will be discussed, but they own up to the ideas that you have. And if they own up to the ideas that you have and adopt them as their position, everything works well. So we say, okay, why don't we have a tripartite legal system? Let's reform the legal and judicial system. Let's have a tripartite one. Let's have the common law. Let's have the Sharia law. Let's have the customary law. Straight away, in principle, agreeable, agreeable, but how? The how was the issue. Of course, the Christians that we are talking of, they started trying to talk about specific provision of Sharia law. And I said, it shouldn't be their own business. They should look at how Sharia law will affect them. And that also worked. So I said, okay, Sharia law, if and when at all it will be implemented, should not be wholesome. It should apply to areas where there are Muslims. And it should never apply to areas where there are Christians. That's one. Two, where is a mixed community, Christian Muslims? Sharia law should be to the extent that it is personal, not really communal. So such as issues of marriage, issues of inheritance, issues of, and even that to do with the Muslims. And then you have the customary law that will deal with the issue of the non-Muslims that want customary law, or common law where both parties are involved. Or even where it is not both parties, whether it is even a Muslim, if you want to go to common law, you're allowed. Look, the thing is, make your own choice. Here are these three legal systems. You have A civil case, choose where you want to take your civil case to. If there is a criminal case where it is between Christian and Muslim, it has to go to common law court. Where certain criminal cases, even if they involve Muslims, they have to go to common law. Where it is criminal, but may not have to go to common law. The Muslim, if he so believes in his faith and wants Sharia law, let him make that choice. And then he'll be taken to Sharia court. So there was really no compulsion. You make a choice, but all the laws are there. And the every judgment to do with capital punishment automatically has to be appealed to the highest court in the land, whether you have the means or not. We made it in such a way that it is mandatory that every case so decided has to go on appeal. So the issue of you don't know your right to appeal, you don't have the means to appeal, does not mean that the case should not be an appeal. If it doesn't go on appeal within a certain period of time, the earlier judgment is quashed. So why we introduce all of this was to make sure that we remove exuberances and excesses. Because we came to notice from what happened in some other places that lower courts, in order to play to the gallery, were fond of just passing even judgment. That when you sit with even the Muslim clerics, senior ones, they say, okay, they were wrong. And the only reason why they were wrong was that they were given total and absolute power at that level. So say, no, we will not give anybody in our laws total and absolute power. Let this power be exhausted to the highest level. And okay, in terms of capital punishment, like murder, where it's either you behead or stone somebody, we did not exclude any form of execution. We did not make it restrictive. We allowed that the court to decide the form, whether it is by hanging, whether it is, okay, we don't have lethal injection here, we have hanging, we have firing squad. These are the forms of execution. The other form of we don't even have beheading here. It has never happened. We don't even, well, we have stoning in our statutes now, but nobody has ever been stoned because is we make it up to the judge to determine the form of execution. And you see, not only that, you can appeal the form of execution in line with the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, up to the Supreme Court of the Federation. So we introduce so many things that, the fundamental objectives of the Constitution as that guarantees rights of individual and all necessary safeguards we introduce. Not in order to refuse to do the right thing, but in order to remove excesses. So that legal and judicial reform was also a major issue apart from the cultural and the traditional reform. We delegated authority to local councils. We said, okay, you don't want sale of alcohol in certain environment, but why should state interfere in that? That's a local or communal issue. Let the local councils decide where alcohol may be sold or not sold, where alcohol may be consumed or not consumed. And when we delegated this authority, you see, it didn't become an issue of Muslims didn't want alcohol sold in certain areas. You go to certain areas where there are Muslim alcohol, it's sold. You go to certain areas where there are Christian alcohol, it's not sold. Because, no, we're not drunkards. We don't want alcohol. Even if you sell alcohol, you have to sell within this time to this time. So it became an issue not based on religion, but based on what they feel is right for their communities. So they had comprehensive reform of delegating authority to local council, of having, you know, a tripartite legal system, did a lot to, first of all, convince the non-Muslims in the state that Sharia law being introduced was more of an issue of personal to Muslims. And even then, there was a question of even choice, even as it affects even the Muslims. Even they themselves have choices. So there were no things which were made in such a way that you have no choice or you have no right of appeal. You have right of appeal from the lowest court of the land to the highest court, not highest court in the state, highest court in the federation.
That's very interesting. And in fact, I'd like to maybe go into each of those reforms that you've discussed.
Yes.
To look step by step at this, at what you did to actually implement them and build support for them, and maybe also discuss the obstacles that you didn't anticipate that perhaps arose. So if we begin with the cultural and traditional reforms, which is that you gave each, you know, ethno-religious group an independent identity and a traditional establishment. Can you explain what were the steps that you took as governor? Did you form committees? Who did you talk to? How did that reform go forward?
Well, we first of all, we invited memoranda. Said ethnic communities that needed that should send memorandum. And in the memorandum, they should identify, they should make recommendation of the ruling houses, whether they have specific ruling houses or is an issue open to every adult male or female. They should identify the kingmakers, those who should make the selection, and they should make recommendation pattern of succession, because this also, each one of these also can become a problem, because even where you have established system, over succession yet problem. So taking, you know, cognizance of what has happened in the country in other places, we say, okay, we will not allow that similar mistake. Let's make a system that will work like a clock, a good clock anyway. so they submitted a memorandum. Some of them, there were no problems. Some of them, even before they could agree on which are the ruling houses, was a problem. We had series of meetings with a number of them. And then, of course, we had to go back into archives and look at historical document. Sometimes some influential, some families have become influential. Suddenly they want to become a ruling house. So we had to go back into archives and say, no, 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 no. On the basis of history, blah, 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 blah. You were never a member of the ruling clan. Yeah, it's, now you are an important family, you are powerful, you are rich, but you are never a ruling clan. So you can hold on to your wealth and influence, but allow those who, based on historical records, really have a right to ascend to, you know, stool, traditional headship, you know, the stool of the leadership of such communities. So it wasn't really easy. Very few of them, really. And for some, we really had to take drastic decisions, take it or leave it. This is it. You want this self-identity, this is how you can have it. And we, for some, we had to take that decision in because of conflicting interests even between the community itself. So we had to try to have a, you know, so a hybrid taken from both sides and say, okay, what can be fair and just, because they, if they can't agree, what will be seen to be just and equitable? And if we work it out, and we call for a meeting, and we lay it before them, Of course, they will not agree. But then we give them an ultimatum. I'm not going to wait for you forever.
Mm-hmm.
Either you remain under the dominance of what you didn't like,
mm-hmm.
or you take what we have. Of course, they ended up taking what you had.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you have complaints about territorial boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So it was wasn't even easy.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly boundary with the old and the biggest, that's the Zazo Emirate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm correcting this, you know, because of the Kaduna being the state capital, like there are the Bajis,
mm-hmm.
which is an ethnic tribe, want to claim ownership of Kaduna. Of course, historically, you can say that they were the people that were dominant there.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at those who populate Kaduna, they're not equally the Bajis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the state capital. So we had a little bit of problem to do with boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
There are some problem to do with ruling houses. Some problem to do with pattern of succession.
Mm-hmm.
In some communities, they say, no, we want rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Some say, no. It should not be rotation. It should be on merit. But some feel that if it is purely on merit, they may not have, they are not assured that their own clan
mm-hmm.
will one day succeed. The only thing which will assure them that one day their clan will rule over their community is if it is succession, if it is rotation.
Mm-hmm.
So we had all these sort of problems, but you know, nothing is impossible once you go through the issue of dialoguing with people.
Mm-hmm.
You need to sit down with people. People should have confidence in you
mm-hmm.
that you are out to do things in their own interest for their own good.
Mm-hmm.
They will keep. And so that's how we mm-hmm. went about, you know, doing this. Every community that made that memorandum,
mm-hmm.
as at that time, with the exception of one single community, got what they wanted,
mm-hmm.
what they deserved. The one single community was because of a small. As at that time, really, they didn't even make the request.
Mm-hmm.
It was later that they forwarded a request. And we are looking into that request, where it was a little bit too late for us
mm-hmm.
to say that we're going to do anything about that. We left it to the present government to look into it.
Mm-hmm.
If they find it worth doing, they do.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, we gave every ethnic tribe
mm-hmm.
itself identity,
mm-hmm.
A structure for traditional rulership, a pattern of succession that is devoid of any possible chance of rancor or conflict. And there have been successions since then
mm-hmm.
because some have died, there were very peaceful succession,
mm-hmm.
no conflicts at all,
mm-hmm.
because we made the laws very, very detailed, very, very clear. As a matter of fact, even the older institutions,
mm-hmm.
we found out that they did not have in law
mm-hmm.
these details. And we knew that if we did not, even for the older institutions, provide this in law,
mm-hmm.
there was going to be conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So we now went and did the same for them. And we are lucky that we did,
mm-hmm.
because some of them, vacancies arose after we did that.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had not done that, it would have been a tug of war.
Mm-hmm.
And after we had done that, from some states in Nigeria, having learned how detailed we went through,
mm-hmm.
came to, and took our legislation
mm-hmm.
to say that, look, they wanted to borrow from how we did our own structure, and so that they can go and look at their own.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they are likely also to run into conflicts and problems when a vacancy arises for succession, you know, for any stool.
Mm-hmm. So from the governor's office or from the state ministries, how was this the team that organized the mediation structured? Did you have a commission? How many people did you have going into communities to help negotiate conflicts? Can you just describe that to me and how long it took?
This exercise took about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
It took about 6 months. It wasn't a commission. The ministry were there. But we didn't want government directly involved from beginning, to be seen to be directly involved.
Which ministry?
Ministry for Local Government and Chieftaincy Affairs. But we asked somebody from the university, an academician, somebody with knowledge of this system, to actually chair this body.
Okay.
One Dr. Jumari, he was a federal, he was in the Independent Electoral Commission, just finished his term at the headquarters here. We asked him to chair, we put other members there, they will receive the memorandum, they will analyze the memorandum, they will make recommendation to government. But as I mentioned earlier, it was just like the judicial reform. You don't send up bodies without knowing where you yourself want to go to. So even as they are working, where they are keeping us informed of what they are getting, they are consulting us, and we are telling them our own side from government. So that at the end of the day, you know, the report they gave, though they were giving us what the communities have brought, what the communities will be happy with, but they also incorporated our government perspective to a large extent. Of course, they were not in a position to resolve the issues of boundaries, the issues of succession pattern, the issue of ruling houses. They did what they could, but they left some of those things that they could not handle to government. And those things that they could not handle, those were the things that we then, as a government, having, you know, now in the process of considering the report, that we had to sit. First of all, we had to sit even with those that had no problem to confirm from them that that was their position. This is your position, fine. Okay, then you can go. At least we have confirmed that the report you have was a reflection of their position. And those that had unfinished businesses, we sat with them over the unfinished businesses until we hammered out a deal that was acceptable to all.
Did you bring in mediators? This was done within the ministry?
No. I personally chaired that.
Okay.
Because, you see, you need, at a certain level, you need a final authority.
And you then wrote the law based on that process?
Based on that process.
And was there any obstacle, were there any obstacles to the National Assembly, or did it go through?
No. All these are within the jurisdiction of the state to deal with.
And were there any unforeseen obstacles in implementing that reform?
Absolutely none. Absolutely none.
It's very straightforward.
Well, the obstacle would have been if we had not followed this process. It was in order to avoid this obstacle that we follow this long process.
Can we look now at the other set of reforms that you mentioned, the judicial and legal reforms? Can you also take me through that process? You mentioned that you pulled together a forum, the Leaders of Thought Forum, that was co-chaired by a Muslim and Christian statesman. How did you decide who would go onto that forum, given that you said there are 50 ethnic groups and, you know, ethno-religious groups?
The
Leaders of Thought Forum.
Okay, there was a question you asked. I want to get back to that. I think I recall. You asked obstacle. Yes, we, in implementation, in some few chiefdoms, we encountered obstacles on the appointment of the first chief or AME of the community. And within the communities now, conflicts arose. And those, some of those conflicts were beginning to assume the proportion that we did not like. And what we did was say, okay, we made another temporal legislation, which gave the governor, that was me, that the power that I may, after due consultation, appoint from among the community anybody found competent as the first chief. So even though, you see, the initial law gave them the power to go back and nominate. And they were having problem even nominating. And it was becoming a security threat.
Mm.
So we had to take away that power from them. Mm-hmm. For the appointment of the first team.
Mm-hmm.
So that was obstacle we encountered in about three, you know, establishments.
Mm-hmm.
So we took away the power,
mm-hmm.
even to nominate, because they could not. And said, the governor shall, after due consultation,
mm-hmm.
appoint the first chief for the community.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that, and they all followed.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a temporary legislation. It only applied to the appointment of the first chief. Mm-hmm. After the appointment of the first chief, then subsequent appointment will have to follow the procedure laid down in the law. Because the first chief now has a responsibility to set up all the structures and institutions established mm-hmm. by the law.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I should mention that as an obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question how on the Leaders of Thought Forum,
mm-hmm.
you need to repeat it.
Sure. That. Again, if we look at this set of reforms, I'm interested in the detail of how you did it. How did you begin to assemble that forum and identify individuals to serve in it?
Well, we know everybody. There are religious groups.
Mm-hmm.
There are socio-cultural groups. There are NGOs. There are professional bodies. So what we went is from the religious group, get equal representation.
Mm-hmm.
From the socio-cultural groups, get equal representation.
Mm-hmm.
From the elders, you know, from the state, get equal representation from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So we went into different groups in the state, you know, and not appointed and got someone to appoint that would be reflective
mm-hmm.
of the structure of our state
mm-hmm.
that we reflect that was reflective mm-hmm. of the divergent views
mm-hmm.
you know in this state.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this forum met, and then this led to the decision to adopt a tripartite legal system. Did the forum produce a report similar to the other committees, and that was adopted then and translated into law by the state?
Yeah, well, they did. What they did was not the law, but they only proposed the tripartite.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when they knowing that they were heading that way, we were also working on our own.
Mm-hmm.
We set up a team of lawyers, legal draftsmen, indigenous to the state,
mm-hmm.
from both Muslim and Christian background.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time they finish, having recommended a tripartite legal system,
mm-hmm.
and some of them had participated even in the Leaders of Thought Forum,
mm-hmm.
we said, okay, here is this. Give us draft legislations.
Mm-hmm.
So they work the, well, we already have the common law.
Mm-hmm.
So the draft legislation really had to do with that to do with the Sharia law,
mm-hmm.
that to do with the customary law.
Mm-hmm.
And that also that we repeal the area courts.
Mm-hmm.
Because the area courts then were administering both Sharia and customary law.
Okay.
So what we did basically was to separate the function of the area courts.
Mm-hmm.
And provide, instead of area courts, you had now Sharia and customary courts.
Did you encounter resistance from people who were in those area courts? And how did you deal with
that? Well, the issue was that, you see, the area courts personnel, most of them had no problem, you know, serving in the Sharia court.
Mm-hmm.
But hardly was there anyone that could serve in the customary court.
Mm-hmm.
So they were assigned to serve where they best fitted.
Mm-hmm.
We had to recruit fresh personnel
mm-hmm.
that could serve in the customary court. So, and those even who Even the Sharia court said, no, 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 not all of them are qualified. We are going to conduct aptitude test.
Mm-hmm.
So fine. They conducted aptitude test. Those they found competent
mm-hmm.
were returned.
Mm-hmm.
Those they did not find competent, we asked the judiciary, because they were judiciary staff. If they had need for them,
mm-hmm.
they could return them.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't have need for them, they could retire them.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out.
In setting up this process of appeals that would reduce the discretion reforms, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
You were the one talking or you were asking a question? I thought I answered the question.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask, you mentioned that one of the purposes of separating, oh, sorry, of creating this process of appeal was to reduce the discretion of lower judges because that on occasion led to excess. How did those judges react? And was that something you had to negotiate to reduce their area of discretion?
No, there wasn't any reaction from them. The judges were and are still employees of government. So, I mean, it's not as if, you know, they have any particular interest other than to interpret and apply the law.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever the law is that's their job. They appear to do a job. So we didn't expect any reaction from them, and we didn't get any.
Okay. As with the other reform, were there any unforeseen obstacles that emerged?
Well, you see, when you are reforming a society, you just don't approach a society only with the reform itself. You have to earn and return the confidence of the society or the people you are reforming. And we combine these reforms with other government policies and programs that people were interested in. We had this series of town hall meetings, if you may call them,
mm-hmm.
or some of them, you know, when we visited the community, some of them when they come to us. And we use those meetings to let the people tell us what they think of our government,
mm-hmm.
let them tell us what they expect from us,
mm-hmm.
Their priorities in terms of provision of services on all infrastructures and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this community says, oh, we don't have good road. If only gaming will do the road from so-so point A through CD, so-so-so. So we don't have any school. The only school we have was blown up by the wind, by the storm sometime. It has not been repaired. We don't have a hospital. Mm-hmm. We don't have good drinking water, access to good drinking water. So we, using those town hall meetings, while these reforms were contemplated or implemented, as the case may be, because, you know, you do this over a period of time, over years, we use this town hall meeting to listen to other things people expect from government.
Mm-hmm.
And we make sure that as soon as we get these requirements, you know, of the people,
mm-hmm.
they begin to see an action.
Mm-hmm.
For those who complain of access, lack of access road,
mm-hmm.
Lack of electricity, within a short period of time, they will see assessors going there to survey, to assess, and say, I remember where with the government was, they are already here, they are looking. We may be planning for the next year, but as far as they are concerned, at least we have gone to see for ourselves,
mm-hmm.
the engineers and the actors and whatever, and are assessing. And within a reasonable period of time, they will see government activity in addressing those particular areas.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, the reforms come together with also doing to people,
mm-hmm.
serving people, providing to people,
mm-hmm.
what they have made requests to government, you know,
mm-hmm.
what their expectations of governments are, what their needs are,
mm-hmm.
then it made it easier for all the forms also to be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you see, you can't reform a hungry man.
Mm-hmm.
You can't reform a totally dissatisfied individual. But if somebody, you are satisfying his needs in one form or another, it is easier to reform.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like how you train animals. I mean, you have to train animals by enticing them with one thing or the other.
Mm.
And we are all animals. We are humans, but we are all animals. So you to make us accept certain things, maybe we need to be getting certain things also in return.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and that's why, with all sense of majesty, that up now they continue to talk about our government, and that it was only during a period that they knew that there was government. Of course, I have a successor, but I know, as every other Nigerian, most Nigerian you talk to, that you go to the state now, they only talk about the last administration.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what we did to restore peace, and because of what we did to meet their needs and reform the entire society.
Can we talk more about that? Because I think ideally every government should be responsive to the needs of its people, but
yes.
Sometimes, you know, people might say these are our problems, but they never see them addressed. So firstly, if you could just explain to me, you know, the town hall meetings where the agenda first got set, how often did they happen and how many people would attend that typically?
Well, we do not limit people. It depends on the venue. As I mentioned, you see, such meetings were either when we visited them or sometimes they write they want to visit us. When they write that they want to visit us, you see that they will come with all the opinion leaders and the leaders from their community, male and female alike, all of them, mm-hmm. young and old. So when they come, they will pay courtesy call, they will read out, these are their needs, blah, blah, blah. They just go down, and there and then, what we could do, we'll tell them, okay, you can have ABCD within this time frame.
Mm-hmm.
ABCD will look within a given time frame.
Okay.
And whatever we told them, they only see us fulfilling, you know,
mm-hmm.
whatever we promise them.
Mm-hmm.
And if we visited them, the crowds tend to be larger.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there will be a spokesman. He also will read out all their complaints as a community. And we address them. Okay, fine, we have had, you know, within this time frame, you have this, within that time frame, you have that. And of course, there was some kind of skepticism from beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But once you start to implement, and people, and, you know, words get wrong. They say, oh, no, we've been to the governor, we promised all this, and we're having it.
Mm-hmm.
So people became patient because they knew that if they don't get it today, they'll get it tomorrow.
Okay. So you helped to set people's expectations by discussing with them what you could do.
Absolutely. We got from them what they needed. We didn't sit in office to determine what we should do to them.
Was there anything that you needed to know from them? Were there any questions that you consistently asked people in helping to understand what their needs were? Or did you wait for them to give you
the No, you see, even if we knew of such, you see, the issue is if somebody tells you his problem and you address, even if you knew of the problem before, he appreciates it more
mm-hmm.
if it is when he has told you.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, as a government, you have to even sometimes pretend you don't even know certain things,
mm-hmm.
whilst somebody is telling you. He may be telling you what you already know, what you already have planned for.
Mm-hmm.
And when he has told you, then okay, you are saying okay, you have heard him, blah blah blah, blah, and you look into it. You do this, you do that. He will go happy. He has communicated with you, and you have communicated with him, and he sees result. So you. engaging people in a set of such as ours is very, very important. It's good for the people to know that they have an input into what Gemi is doing for them. Gemi is not all-knowing, all-powerful, that it doesn't even have time for them. They just determine what, you know, what they want to do for them.
Mm-hmm.
No, people don't like that.
How often would you go into communities?
Well, very frequent. I mean, if we didn't go, they were always coming. You know, I run a very, very open government.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very open government.
Mm-hmm.
Very engaging and open government.
Mm-hmm. And so once you had a sense of you were going to do this in this community, how did you make that happen? How did you send the directive to the relevant agency?
Well, I always go with the heads of relevant agencies, because what are the issues of education, issues of agriculture, issue of health, issues of infrastructure such as roads and power.
Mm-hmm.
I always go with heads or the deputy heads of such establishments. And apart from that, I have my own personal staff who take note in case, you know, duty takes a number of them out, you know, they can follow me because certain things may require their attention somewhere else. But notes are taken. And when we return, okay, this review the notes. And then, of course, then I pass directives to communicate to the relevant heads to look into those things within the concept of our medium or, well, we never, not much of a long term. Because, you see, when you have a lot of problems, your problems will have to be immediate and medium. So,
how did you hold those heads of agencies to account?
Well, there's a budgetary process. Before each budget, you know, you see, all, like, say, for a given particular year, the sessions with these people from January to up to July, August, will substantially form how we budget for the next year. So, the budgetary process, you know, and the financial regulations, you know, holds people accountable, for how they carry out or discharge their function and responsibilities.
So, if you ensure that, say, the Department of Education has an adequate budget to do their work, and you've asked them to deal with the school in community X, but you find that within a certain time period they haven't, or how would you evaluate whether they had, and how would you deal with the situation if they hadn't?
Well, because we run an open government, first of all, works are tendered publicly, you know, so it's not something you give in secret. You publish in the dailies, you know, for prospective bidders to bid, you open the bids, you assess the bids, you award publicly, is announced, so the community know that a certain job has been awarded. And if, because of the openness, if no action, it also gets back to you from the community. Two, the representatives in the legislature from the community will also report back to you that this thing we have done, nothing is going on. Two, the heads of the councils, local council elected, will also report to you that, look, sir, we thank you, this has been done, but no progress. Again, within the implementing ministries or the Ministry of Finance, there are monitoring units. So, but the monitoring unit for the implementing ministry may not report itself to you, but the monitoring unit of the budget office will implement on budget performance. And that one is under the governor's office.
Okay, great. If we go back to the fourth set of reforms that you mentioned, which was to delegate responsibilities to local authorities and councils, you know, some people have spoken of the difficulty that a leader might face in devolving power, because that then empowers local people, and they may not be sure of the quality of that local individual. They may not, you know, be they may not have a very strong ability to hold that person to account because they're chosen by whatever local basis. Was that something that you had to consider or deal with? Did any problems arise because of that?
Well, yes. Generally in Nigeria, not just in the state that I govern, the problem of capacity at the local level mm-hmm. is a serious issue.
Mm-hmm.
There's a serious lack of capacity. You find that they don't have engineers,
mm-hmm.
they don't have architects,
mm-hmm.
they don't have legal personnel, they don't have medical doctors.
Mm-hmm.
We have this problem generally in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
But the devolution I was referring to was devolution to do with the judicial and legal issue.
Mm-hmm.
So the appointees were not local government appointees.
Mm-hmm.
They were state appointees qualified,
okay.
But then they could make bylaws that had to do with certain local peculiarities,
mm-hmm.
such as, because the most common was the issue of legalizing, issue of prostitution, mm-hmm. alcohol, intoxicants. These are the local issues that were of serious concern.
Mm-hmm.
To agitators for Sharia law
mm-hmm.
at the local level. But then they also became issues of serious concern, not even to those agitating for Sharia law.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay, it's good. But since the local communities are very interested, let these matters be legislated and controlled by the local councils
mm-hmm.
so that it makes it easier for the community, if things are not going, to just quickly reach their local leaders there,
mm-hmm.
and together they can address those issues. They are not delegation per se in terms of issue of health, issue of agriculture, because that this kind of the delegation in terms of services,
mm-hmm.
Provision of infrastructure and other things are provided for in the constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So as a governor, I had no power to interfere, you know, in what the Constitution of the Federal Republic has delegated to the local council
mm-hmm.
or what it has delegated to the state.
Mm-hmm.
So is it also the federal cannot interfere with what the Constitution has delegated, you know, to the state.
Mm-hmm.
But on the judicial and legislative issues
mm-hmm.
to deal with these local vices,
mm-hmm.
that's where we talk of the issue of legislation.
Okay. A broad question that I have then about all of these reforms is that you mentioned that it was important to give people recognition, and you developed institutional forms to give people ways to represent themselves and to represent their interests and to have a community identity that was not in conflict with others. On the one hand, that promotes a sort of more inclusive society if people feel that their identity is being respected. But on the other hand, people might argue that that would lead to greater divisions, and it might lead to those divisions being entrenched. How did you address that?
Well, Council of Chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
We created the state Council of Chiefs, where at the state level, all these chiefs have a council.
Mm-hmm.
They meet from time to time to discuss issues of common interest, issues of general interest.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to report to government on those particular issues. On issues they need to report to government, they report to government. On issues they require government attention, they report to government. But we have an independent state council of chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
Two, like in some local councils, you may have three or four chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a local council there where they meet at that local level
mm-hmm.
as one, and you know, and all that. So even though you have this local identity,
mm-hmm.
but you have at different level
mm-hmm.
such an institution that brings everybody also together as one,
mm-hmm.
discussing common issues, streamlining issues,
mm-hmm.
Issues of anything to do with public enlightenment, issues of mm-hmm. health, issues of mm-hmm. agriculture, issues, all matters, issues of security. So these other layers of interaction took care of the issue of what will I say, kind of segregation or separatism. There was not a separatism. There was independence, but there was a collective functioning as a community. There was unity in the way and manner we they function or we function as a state.
Were there any, again, unforeseen obstacles in the development of those councils?
The only unforeseen obstacle, you see, these chiefs, they are so envious of each other. They like to, they like, you know, there is always this issue of ranking. Even among themselves, okay, I'm higher than that person, I'm higher than that person. So you have to be careful going through historical antecedents and rank them. First class, second class, third class. So that we don't have any class higher than the first. But even among the first class, there are seniors by a certain other order. So the only obstacle was for us to go through and for all of them to define their rank in this order. And we did so, and it's working. There is no problem.
Okay, great. When you developed and devised these reforms to address the problems you encountered, could you draw on any pre-existing strategy? Did you refer to other countries' experiences? Was there any source of inspiration for these ideas, or was it sort of internally devised?
For the ideas that I had?
Yeah, for these various reforms, the cultural reforms, the legal and judicial reforms.
Well, I tell you my background. I came from a community that has always been highly political, active political, active, we are political activists. Right before independence. And even my educational background was a school in the eastern part of the country, in Enugu, as a matter of fact. People were wondering at my age then what I was going to do in Enugu just after the Civil War. So I had this wide experiences, you know, contact with people from different parts of the country. So I was, right from my youth, really a reformist.
And if you had that idea of the reforms that you wanted to advance, how did you build popular support for those reforms? First within the government, and then maybe we can talk about how you built a sort of public constituency for their support. But were you able to, did you have to work to build support amongst your cabinet, amongst the assemblymen, amongst other people within the government? And how did you go about doing that?
Yes, well, you see, because already the society was desirous of those reforms. But the issue was who would be man enough to face off to the challenge. It was always the issue of the decision maker. Not that the reforms were unnecessary or untimely or nobody was seeking for them. I told you that some of this for decades, some up to a century, there had been agitations. But who could take the bull by the horn? And we did. We did. Yes. What did I do to build kind of support? I knew where the opposition was going to come from.
Where was that?
Well, from those who are dominant over the system. And when I looked at it in totality, I was going to please majority and please even though powerful minority. But I also kind of had to be, had to, you know, prepare myself to absorb all insults and intimidation from the powerful minority. Not to act to any negativity, not to become annoyed, not to, I became like even somebody that didn't even know what he was doing. But I knew what I was doing. So there were a lot of insults, there were threats, there were abuses. I ignored all of them. But I believe that when the reform began to take place, people will see wisdom in what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things will give way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what is happening now.
Mm-hmm.
Even those who are vehemently against,
mm-hmm.
calling me names, writing all sorts of articles, going over the electronic media, inciting these people, saying this, saying that, now are singing a different song.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, we apologize, we misunderstood you. Now we see the wisdom of if you had not done ABCD,
mm-hmm.
maybe our position would have been this bad or that bad or that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you see, we have this thing from this historically, those who come from the urban area,
mm-hmm.
and those who come from the rural area.
Mm.
I happen to come from the rural area, and of course we are the majority.
Mm-hmm.
So those who come from the urban area tended more to oppose the reform.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to build my support more around the majority,
mm-hmm.
rural community where I came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my solace and protection and mm-hmm. support more from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
But they are the majority. Those from the rural area constituted 80% of the populace.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you are talking in terms of political power, voting power,
mm-hmm.
whether the people in the urban area like it or not,
mm-hmm.
if the rural communities in the states like you, they will vote you into office.
Mm.
So, but still then, in the urban area also, there was urban decay, there was this, there was that. So in spite of all the insults and the blab and the intimidation and the threats, we do not say no because they were against us, against our policies. They will pay by means of denying them of access to government facilities. No. We provided them with things that for some, for 50, 60 years they mm-hmm. never had.
Mm-hmm.
We provided them with key services.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to go around these urban areas now and drive around, it may be the best place apart from Abuja in Nigeria that you would drive through.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of easy accessibility and the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
So, also that one made even the urban area later on to become a kind of ashamed of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We've been insulting this guy, we've been doing it, but he has not taken this, you know, personal.
Mm-hmm.
He still attends to our needs.
Mm-hmm.
That also gave way. You see, if leaders begin to react negatively because of criticisms or obstacles or insult or whatever,
mm-hmm.
they will miss the point.
Mm-hmm.
They will miss the point. If a reform is paining somebody, people must cry out. Yeah, that's natural.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like somebody being receiving, being vaccinated or injected. Once you know your body is external, something getting into your body, you feel the pinch. Yeah, so, but it's for good. And that's how it should be.
Was the opposition able to do anything to sort of put speed bumps or obstacles in your way to these reforms, and how did you overcome this?
Yeah, they did, but you see, from a weak point.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I mentioned, the opposition was more from the urban centers, two urban centers for that matter,
mm-hmm.
and those who are dominant over the entire system. Whereas what we are doing was in the interest of 80% of the populace. So the opposition had only about 20% of the populace to deal with. Of what significance would that be? But they had their say.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our way.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to make any bargains with them to get their support?
Well, they thought we were even going to go further than what we did. There was this nagging suspicion that we were even going to go much, much further than what we did.
Mm-hmm.
We assured them that we are not heading in the direction they thought we were heading.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't trust us from the beginning. But of course, when we came out, they saw that we did not do it. Even though that suspicion was still there, hanging that, okay, tomorrow or next tomorrow or the day, but they saw that, no. And we made it clear. I think I even made broadcast that that was as far as we could go on that reform aspect, and let people should now address themselves to the issue of how we can all work together. We have what we want as separate communities.
Mm-hmm.
Let's know how we can work together, bring synergy into the system. Let the whole units work as one for the good of all.
What were their fears?
Pardon?
What were their fears?
Well, their fears were that in terms of territory, they thought we were going to go encroach more further into the territories.
Okay.
We didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
They even thought that we were going to even up north where there was no need, no cultural or religious differences.
Mm-hmm.
We were even going to go there and start creating chiefdoms. We didn't do that.
Okay.
They even thought that we are going to attempt to dethrone.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do that. Because of the opposition to us, they thought that we were mad with them. We were going to begin to dethrone some of them. We didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just natural to feel pain and to resist.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the town hall meetings as an important way to show people that you were interested in their concerns and to build a public constituency for support of your reforms. Was there anything else that you did to get the public on your side?
Well, saying what, doing whatever we say, if we promise, we deliver.
Mm-hmm.
And apart from that, you see, on a permanent basis, apart from this institution, you know, you see, when you do certain things,
mm-hmm.
you need the people to continue to participate in one form or another to deal with some of the issues that potentially could cause crisis. We created this inter-religious forum, a permanent body that used to meet every quarter. It's made up of religious leaders from all across the state.
Mm-hmm.
And quarterly, we used to meet. And not only discuss on issues of potential ethnic or religious conflict, but they used to bring to us report card of government from the area.
Mm-hmm.
How do their people view government? What is the people's expectation from the area they come from on government policy A, government policy B? So we use that as, you know, further to enhance information flowing to government through the religious leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And also we set up within the forum itself standing committees to deal with issues that may arise so that issues will not wait until we meet. When issues arose, the standing bodies will go and deal with those issues and only make a report at the next meeting how they handle it.
Okay.
So as a standing, it's up to now that establishment is there and it's working very well.
Excellent. One question about when you came into office was, how did you find the people that had the right skills to do the jobs that you need them to do? As you're seeking to appoint people to important positions, did you struggle to find people with the necessary skills? How did you identify them?
Well, having worked in the state, you know, for 3 years, in the cabinet of the state for 3 years, of course, I got to know a number of people. I got to know the public service of the state. And I must say that we had and still have one of the best qualified state public service in Nigeria. Of course, because that was the capital of the northern northern region then. So in terms of public service, yes, there were qualified functional public service to deliver. What we needed were the political heads, the political appointees. the secretaries of the ministers or the commissioners for the minister, as the case may be. And even though we call for nominations, here too we engage people. Like we make sure that different parts of the state were represented. And we call those parts to make nomination. Of course, we set criteria of the kind of individuals that should nominate.
Can you give an example of the criteria?
Well, educational qualification. You have to be a graduate. You have to have certain years of experience. You have to be of proving integrity. There must not be, you must not have been found of guilty of any crime or breach of trust and whatever. And if there are any other information, the individual's contribution to society, you know, they should, you know, provide such. So they did that. In some places, we on our own had to take on technocrats because you have to blend. You just don't throw away everything that has to come. So a blend of the technocrats we brought with qualified nominees for these offices. And a nomination was not an individual. They may send you a list of 10, 12 names. Now, when you have the list, maybe you need one or two. So you scrutinize, you assess, and you make a selection. At the end of the day, the selection still is from the nomination. So the communities feel happy that at least they participated, you know, in nominating people to serve in your government. So they see it as their government because they participated in the nomination process of people serving in your government.
As you ask communities to make nominations, was that still on a party political basis?
Yes, but because I also gave a slot to other political parties, two in particular, that we form a government of unity. Not that they didn't score even 15% of representation in town. Not votes, they had in terms of vote maybe 30%, but in terms of, if you are talking of seats won, maybe 5-10% or so. But we still gave them some slots, and we asked the political parties to make nominations.
Was that something that was difficult to sell to your party if you said that you were giving up seats to another party?
No, absolutely no.
Great. Did you take efforts to train your staff, or was capacity development an important issue for you, and how did you do that?
Train them.
Yeah, or just in sort of ensure that training occurred.
Well, of course, you see, donor agencies help a lot, you know, in training appointees. Apart from training by donor agencies, there are other national programs where, you know, all these training and programs, you know, were conducted. And our appointees participated a lot.
Did you take any steps to ensure that your team members and employees devoted themselves to carrying out their mission? So perhaps creating incentive systems for them to perform to your expectations?
Training center for them?
Sorry, incentives.
Oh, incentive. Well, what incentive? Because you see, there are specified remuneration. I don't state the remunerations are set at the center. We have at the center the revenue mobilization allocation and fiscal commission, and they set nationally remunerations for all political appointees at all levels. So we have no hand in fixing those remunerations. You know, what your remuneration will be is set at the center. That's how far, you know, you can have. But then you perform well. You retain your job. You don't perform. Somebody else comes in. So the incentive is that as long as you deliver, you have the chance of serving until the end of the game. If you are failing to deliver, then definitely we give way.
Many leaders face pressure to provide jobs to important people, difficult factions, or family members. And some of the officials that you may have hired may have felt this pressure. but there are still trade-offs. You may want the reform to work, but you can't move forward without accommodating some of these appointments. Did this a problem arise for you, and did you come up with any strategies to balance or manage these different imperatives?
I never appointed any family member of mine into any position. Mm-hmm. I never did that. No family member of mine even got any contract mm-hmm. under my head. Mm-hmm. No family member of mine except one got mm-hmm. a piece of land mm-hmm. and land allocation mm-hmm. for one, of course, followed the process. He's a businessman mm-hmm. for a showroom, mm-hmm. and he got, and even that land, I think, was a federal land. Mm-hmm. But we, of course, we had a hand in recommending. So you see, I shielded completely my mm-hmm. family from governance. Mm-hmm. It was, in my opinion, wrong mm-hmm. to involve my family mm-hmm. in governance. Of course, they supported me politically in campaigning for mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. In association, but not in participating in governance. Mm-hmm.
This question applies also to people that, you know, from difficult factions within the party, or, you know, if your officials below you felt that pressure and perhaps responded to it or not. But did you have to deal with that pressure on different members of the government to appoint people on some sort of political or personal preference?
Of course, in developing democracy, you always have that. I had that. But you see, we are leaders to take on, to absorb pressure. Mm-hmm. You know, you must be pressured, but mm-hmm. it's what you do at the end of the day. At the end of the day is that you take the decision because they're the best that you could have taken at a particular time. Mm-hmm. And we took the decisions at those particular times because they are the best decisions that we could take. Mm-hmm. Pressures unavoidable, mm-hmm. but you are not there to succumb to every pressure.
Yeah. How would you suggest that people manage those pressures?
Well, you see, if you are providing good governance, mm-hmm. you can easily resist pressure. Mm-hmm. If you are not, you have to succumb to pressure. Mm-hmm. Because the only person that can pressure you is the person that has access to you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The person who cannot have access to you cannot pressure you. And the person who has access to you can hold you to ransom mm-hmm. if he knows that down there you are weak. But he knows that you are weak. There is a limit to, he can't, he knows that he can't even pressure you. Mm-hmm. So, you see, the solution to dealing with pressure is really providing good governance. Mm-hmm. If you are providing good governance, everybody will be careful on how he relates or interacts with you. Mm-hmm. Because he knows that you are not really leaning on him in any particular manner. Mm-hmm. One-on-one, we can go your way. Mm-hmm. So it's either he participates and gives his contribution mm-hmm. or he gets out. Okay. So the best way to deal with pressure is provide good governance. Then you don't have to lean on people who will be applying pressure on you mm-hmm. in order to extract favors. Mm-hmm.
I understand that after some of the violence in 2000, I believe, the president came to visit the area and made certain recommendations. In general, what would you say the role of the central government has been in this reform effort?
They didn't interfere in our reform in mm-hmm. any way. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, they didn't even think we were going to go as far as we did, mm-hmm. but they were supportive. Mm-hmm. When they understood where we are heading, they didn't try to stop us, mm-hmm. but in a way they're a bit cynical, thinking that we may not go as far as we wanted, mm-hmm. but we did, mm-hmm. and I'm sure they were happy and so forth that we did. So from the center, it was an endorsement of our openness, of our reform mm-hmm. moves, and our style of going about doing the reform. Mm-hmm.
This project is meant to inform other reform leaders of strategies for how to deal with situations of governance. What would you suggest to other people in a similar position about how to balance that relationship with the central authority on one side and your relationship with your constituency on the other to create that space for reform in your sphere?
Well, you see, environments differ and relationships differ. Mm-hmm. with the central authority, my experience was that when the crisis came and first of all, they didn't believe that we could deal with the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to show by your words and action, not just word, by your action,
mm-hmm.
that you are capable of dealing with the situation. If the central authority becomes convinced that you are capable,
mm-hmm.
they will give you time and support.
Mm-hmm.
If they perceive that you are not capable, then you begin to see interferences. Two is that you need to keep the central authority informed, fully informed.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't keep central authority informed, then misinformation might work. People who may want to abort your reform and have access to central authority
mm-hmm.
can come and paint a different picture from what you are doing or where you are heading. But why are you keeping central authority informed? Even if people come and talk, they have heard from you. They have seen from you. Not just telling them by word of mouth. Why you make certain things in documentary available? Make it available to them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you hear their views. They may advise you. They may not like one aspect of the reform,
mm-hmm.
but you don't also have to do what they want, but at least you are not keeping anything hidden away from them.
Mm-hmm.
You are looking at totality of issues. So one is the issue of earning the confidence of central authority, keeping central authority informed
mm-hmm.
at all times,
mm-hmm.
so that you know busybodies will not, opponents of what you are doing,
mm-hmm.
cannot, you know, try to come and bring divide between you and central authority.
Mm-hmm.
Then you find yourself at conflict with mm-hmm. the central authority and conflict with at home.
Mm-hmm.
You lose out at the end of the day, no matter how laudable, you know, mm-hmm. you know your reform, your objectives.
Mm-hmm. In such a divided society, when you have a sort of competitive process that awards something to one group or one individual and seems to leave another group out of the system, that can cause further tensions. Did you come up with any ways to address this, or do you have any ways about thinking about how you can prevent those tensions from arising when you have something like any form of an electoral process, or if you have like a procurement process or something that threatens to create divisions and this sort of hostility between groups who feel left out of a winner-take-all system?
I don't get your point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't get your point. Are you talking of electoral system? Or?
Well, it doesn't have to be sort of a state-level election,
yeah.
but just any sort of competition where, you know, there's a tendency, or, you know, if you make an appointment and you appoint this person, this group feels left out, or if there's a competitive bid for something and this group feels left out. Do you think there are any strategies for dealing with that kind of situation in a divided context?
Well, it also depends on how you are running your government.
Mm-hmm.
You see, in societies such as ours, it's always good you carry as many people as possible along
mm-hmm.
without really going against your principles of providing good governance. If you want to go it alone, if you want to go in a more restrictive manner,
mm-hmm.
you have to be absolutely sure now the general populace are in your support, which means you have a policy which the general populace supports,
mm-hmm.
you have their goodwill, you have their backing, then you can damn all these power brokers around.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
What I prefer, in my opinion, is that you need to strike an equilibrium, you need to strike a balance.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need the peace, tranquility, and harmony really to achieve, to mm-hmm. get anywhere. So I don't believe in winner take all. I think even among opponents, seeming opponents,
mm-hmm.
there are people that can generally help you to achieve your objective.
Mm-hmm.
When the time to defer politically comes, we can still defer.
Mm-hmm.
But when it is time to serve,
mm-hmm.
bring on board anybody capable
mm-hmm.
of helping you to achieve your objectives
mm-hmm.
of providing good governance.
Mm-hmm.
There should be no exclusiveness in that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
It's an issue of all. If elections are over, they're over.
Mm-hmm.
Bring in the best.
Mm-hmm.
Provide. That's how you can even. That's how you convert even some people
mm-hmm.
from opponent to political supporters.
Mm-hmm.
So, I am for the inclusiveness
mm-hmm.
rather than exclusiveness
mm-hmm.
in terms of governance.
Mm-hmm. As we wrap up, I'd like to ask you if there's anything in your management style that you think helped you to achieve these reforms.
Well, the principle of the inclusiveness,
mm-hmm.
the principle of openness and accessibility,
mm-hmm.
and I was in government to provide service, not for anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And also, people knew me that I was not somebody who come and start press singing.
Mm-hmm.
I hate you start praising me. I don't like all these sort of protocols. Is that government is a business.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get on with the business of governance. Of course, not like zombies. We are humans. We can joke, we can laugh, but let's pay more attention to governance. If you want to socialize, you sit with your friends, you can socialize and laugh over things and take tea and whatever. You want. That's different. So I think that up to now continues to follow me. People know that you don't come to me to start talking about somebody else. If you come to me, you have to come to me to talk about issues.
Mm-hmm.
Issues and issues and issues. And what we should do and where we are and where we should be and how we should get there. Yes, you get my attention. But if you are coming purely to tell me stories about that person, know that you will not have my ear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that kind of person. And people got to know that. People know that.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped me a lot. So that I, you know, all the garbage and nonsense were elsewhere. And my quality time was left for provision of governance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here in our society, people in position of authority, you find that they tend to listen to people bring in stories of who likes them, who doesn't like them.
Mm.
What's my business? If you are doing the right thing, the majority of the people will like you.
Mm-hmm.
Some will not like you, so what? You are not there to be liked by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But let what you are doing be liked mm-hmm. by the majority of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How important do you think it is for a leader to have a vision or a common story that they can share with people to get them behind their program?
Without a vision, then you're not a leader. Leaders must have vision, otherwise why are you there?
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely important that leaders have a vision.
Mm-hmm.
They have a purpose for even wanting to provide the leadership. And they have not just a vision, they have a roadmap. Not just a roadmap, but they consciously make effort to follow that roadmap, to actualize their vision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. As I mentioned, we're hoping to enable reform leaders to share their experiences and innovations to deal with challenges that arise. Is there anything that you think we've missed out and that you would like to add?
Oh, not really. UVX, UVX, so many questions that I can't even remember all the questions you've asked because I just talk from the heart, you know, so I can't remember all the things that I've said. But whatever I said, you know, from my experiences. And I believe we've covered enough. And reform is not easy. Leadership in an environment such as ours is not easy. But leadership is not really a privilege. I mean, it's not like, it's a privilege for one to provide leadership because there are many who can. But leaders must never think that they're superior beings. They can't, they're not the brightest, they're not the most handsome, they're not the richest, they're not the strongest, but somebody must provide it. And if it is entrusted onto you, you have to know that it's something you have. It's, you have courtesy of the will of the people. So you owe it to them, you provide leadership to them, and providing leadership to them means you're accountable to them. You keep them informed, listen to them, you communicate with them. Leadership without communication cannot work. So I don't know. I believe these are all the things we have covered, so I'm just summarizing. That's my own idea and principle of leadership. And leadership cannot be about accumulation of wealth. You see, you have to make up your mind. Do you want to accumulate wealth? If you want to accumulate wealth, go and concentrate in business. If you want to provide leadership, you don't have to be poor. Most leaders are not poor. You know, even if you are not that, maybe after leadership, even from writing your memos and other things, you may become a little bit well off. You know, you may not be rich. But surely, you don't look for the Bill Gates in leadership.
Great. Thank you very much for your time and your thoughts on the subject.
You're welcome.